I'd like to get back to my questions. Why can't I ever seem to attract enough money in my life? Am I destined to be forever scrimping and scraping? What's blocking me from realizing my full potential regarding money?
My condition is manifested not just by you, but by a great many people.
Everyone tells me it's a problem of self-worth, a lack of self-worth. I've had a dozen New Age teachers tell me that lack of anything is always traceable to lack of self-worth.
That is a convenient simplification. In this case, your teachers are all wrong. You do not suffer from a lack of self-worth. Indeed, your greatest challenge all your life has been to control your ego. Some have said it's been a case of too much self-worth.
Well, here I am again, embarrassed and chagrined, but you are right.
You keep saying you're embarrassed and chagrined every time I simply tell the truth about you. Embarrassment is the response of a person who still has an ego investment in how others see him. Invite yourself to move past that. Try a new response. Try laughter.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Self-worth is not your problem. You are blessed with an abundance of it. Most people are. You all think very highly of yourself, as rightly you should. So self-worth, for the great mass of the people, is not the problem.
What is?
The problem is lack of understanding of the principles of abundance, together usually with a massive misjudgment about what is good and what is evil. Let me give you an example.
Please do.
You carry a thought around that money is bad. You also carry a thought around that God is good. Bless you. Therefore, in your thought system, God and money do not mix.
In a sense, I guess. That's true. That is how I think.
This makes things interesting, because this then makes it difficult for you to take money for any good thing. I mean, if a thing is judged very good by you, you value it less in terms of money. So the better something is, the more worthwhile, the less money it's worth. You are not alone in this. Your whole society believes this. So your teachers make a pittance and your stripteasers a fortune. Your leaders make so little compared to sports figures that they feel they have to steal to make up the difference. Your priests and your rabbis live on bread and water while you throw coins at entertainers. Think about it. Everything on which you place a high intrinsic value, you insist must come cheaply. The lonely research scientist seeking a cure for AIDS goes begging for money, while the woman who writes a book on 100 new ways to have sex that creates tapes and weekend seminars to go with it makes a fortune. This having it all backwards is a propensity with you, and it stems from wrong thought. The wrong thought is your idea about money. You love it, yet you say it is the root of all evil. You adore it, yet you call it filthy lucre. You say that a person is filthy rich. If a person does become wealthy doing good things, you immediately become suspect. You make that wrong. So a doctor had better not make too much money, or had better learn to be discreet about it. And a minister, whoa, she'd really better not make lots of money, assuming you'll even let her she be a minister, or there'll surely be trouble. You see, in your mind, a person who chooses the highest calling should get the lowest pay. Yes, is right. You should think about that, because it is such wrong thought.
I thought there was no such thing as wrong or right.
There isn't. There's only what serves you and what does not. The terms right and wrong are relative terms, and I use them that way when I use them at all. In this case, relative to what serves you, relative to what you say you want, your money thoughts are wrong thoughts. Remember, thoughts are creative. So if you think money is bad, you think yourself good, well, you can see the conflict. Now, you in particular, my son, act out this consciousness in a very big way. For most people, the conflict is not nearly so enormous as for you. Most people do what they hate for a living, so they don't mind taking money for it. Bad for the bad, so to speak. But you love what you do with the days and times of your life. You adore the activities with which you cram them. For you, therefore, to receive large amounts of money for what you do would be, in your thought system, taking bad for the good, and that is unacceptable to you. You'd rather starve than take filthy lucre for pure service, as if some of the service loses its purity if you take money for it. So here we have this real ambivalence about money. Part of you rejects it, and part of you resents not having it. Now the universe doesn't know what to do about that, because the universe has received two different thoughts from you. So your life with regard to money is going to go in fits and starts, Because you keep going in fits and starts about money. You don't have a clear focus. You're not really sure what's true for you. The universe is just a big photocopy machine. It simply produces multiple copies of your thoughts. Now, there's only one way to change all that. You have to change your thought about it.
How can I change the way I think? The way I think about something is the way I think about something. My thoughts, my attitudes, my ideas were not created in a minute. I have to guess they're the result of years of experience, a lifetime of encounters. You're right about the way I think about money. But how do I change that?
This could be your most interesting question. The usual method of creation for most human beings is a three-step process involving thought, word, and deed or action. First comes thought, the formative idea, the initial concept. Then comes the word. Most thoughts ultimately form themselves into words, which are often then written or spoken. This gives added energy to the thought, pushing it out into the world where it can be noticed by others. Finally, in some cases, words are put into action, and you have what you call a result. A physical world manifestation of what all started with a thought. Everything around you in your man-made world came into being in this way, or some variation of it. All three creation centers were used. But now comes the question. How to change a sponsoring thought? Yes, that is a very good question, and a very important one. For if humans do not change some of their sponsoring thoughts, humankind could doom itself into extinction. The most rapid way to change a root thought or sponsoring idea is to reverse the thought, word, deed process.
Explain that.
Do the deed that you want to have the new thought about. Then say the words that you want to have your new thought about. Do this often enough, and you'll train the mind to think a new way.
Train the mind? Isn't that like mind control? Isn't that just mental manipulation?
Do you have any idea how your mind came up with the thoughts it now has? Do you not know that your world has manipulated your mind to think as you do? Wouldn't it be better for you to manipulate your mind and for the world too? Would you not be better off to think the thoughts you want to think than those of others? Are you not better armed with creative thoughts than with reactive thoughts? Your mind is filled with reactive thought, thought that springs from the experience of others. Very few of your thoughts spring from self-produced data, much less self-produced preferences. Your own root thought about money is a prime example. Your thought about money, it is bad, runs directly counter to your experience. It's great to have money. So you have to run around and lie to yourself about your experience in order to justify your root thought. You're so rooted in this thought, it never occurs to you that your idea about money may be inaccurate. So now, what we are up to is coming up with some self-produced data. And that is how we change a root thought and cause it to be your root thought and not another's. You have one more root thought about money, by the way, which I've yet to mention.
What's that?
That there's not enough. In fact, you have this root thought about just about everything. There's not enough money, there's not enough time, there's not enough love, there's not enough food, water, compassion in the world. Whatever there is that's good, there is just not enough. This race consciousness of not enoughness creates and recreates the world as you see it.
Okay, so I have two root thoughts, sponsoring thoughts, to change about money.
Oh, at least two. Probably many more. Let's see. Money is bad. Money is scarce. Money may not be received for doing God's work. That's a big one with you. Money is never given freely. Money doesn't grow on trees, when in fact it does. Money corrupts.
I see. I get it. I've got a lot of work to do.
Oh, yes, you do. If you're not happy with your present money situation, on the other hand, it's important to understand that you're unhappy with your present money situation because you're unhappy with your present money situation.
You know, sometimes you're hard to follow.
Sometimes you're hard to lead.
Say, listen, you're the God here. Why don't you make it easy to understand?
I have made it easy to understand.
Then why don't you just cause me to understand if that's what you truly want?
I truly want what you truly want. Nothing different, nothing more. Don't you see that that is my greatest gift to you? If I wanted for you something other than what you want for you, and then went so far as to cause you to have it, where's your free choice? How can you be a creative being if I am dictating what you shall be, do, and have? My joy is in your freedom, not your compliance.
Okay. Okay, what did you mean, I'm unhappy with my money situation because I'm unhappy with my money situation?
You are what you think you are. The vicious circle when the thought is a negative one. You've got to find a way to break out of the circle. So much of your present experience is based on your previous thought. Thought leads to experience, which leads to thought, which leads to experience. This can produce constant joy when the sponsoring thought is joyous. It can and does produce continual hell when the sponsoring thought is hellacious. The trick is to change sponsoring thought. I was about to illustrate how to do this.
Go.
Thank you. The first thing to do is reverse the thought-word-deed paradigm. You remember the old adage, think before you act?
Yes.
Well, forget it. If you want to change a root thought, you have to act before you think. Example, you're walking down the street, come across an old lady begging for quarters. You realize she's a bag lady that's living day to day. You instantly know that as little money as you have, you surely have enough to share with her. Your first impulse is to give her some change. There's even a part of you that's ready to reach in your pocket for a little folding money. A one or even a five. What the heck? Make it a grand moment for her. Light her up. Then thought comes in. What? Are you crazy? We've only got $7 to get us through the day. You want to give her a five? So you start fumbling around for that one. Thought again. Hey, come on. You don't have that many of these that you can just give them away. Give us some coins, for heaven's sake. Let's get out of here. Quickly, you reach into the other pocket to try to come up with some quarters. Your fingers feel only nickels and dimes. You're embarrassed. Here you are, fully clothed, fully fed, and you're going to nickel and dime this poor woman who has nothing? You try in vain to find a quarter or two. Oh, there's one, deep in the fold of your pocket. But by now you've walked past her, smiling wanly, and it's too late to go back. She gets nothing. You get nothing either. Instead of the joy of knowing your abundance and sharing, you now feel as poor as the woman. Why didn't you just give her the paper money? It was your first impulse, but your thought got in the way. Next time, decide to act before you think. Give the money. Go ahead. You've got it. There's more where that came from. That's the only thought which separates you from the bag lady. You're clear there's more where that came from, and she doesn't know that. When you want to change a root thought, act in accordance with the new idea you have. But you must act quickly, or your mind will kill the idea before you know it. I mean that literally. The idea of the new truth will be dead in you before you've had a chance to know it. So act quickly when the opportunity arises. And if you do this often enough,
your mind will soon get the idea. It will be your new thought.
Oh, I just got something. Is that what's meant by the new thought movement?
If not, it should be. New thought is your only chance. It's your only real opportunity to evolve, to grow, to truly become who you really are. Your mind is right now filled with old thoughts. Not only old thoughts, but mostly someone else's old thoughts. It's important now, it's time now, to change your mind about some things. This is what evolution is all about.
Why can't I do what I really want to do with my life and still make a living?
What? You mean you actually want to have fun in your life and still earn your keep? Brother, are you dreaming?
What?
I'm only kidding. Just doing a little mind reading, that's all.
Hmm.
You see, that's been your thought about it.
Well, it's been my experience.
Yes, well, we've been all through this a number of times. The people who make a living doing what they love are the people who insist on doing so. They don't give up. They never give in. They dare life not to let them do what they love. But there's another element that must be brought up, because this is the missing element in most people's understanding when it comes to life work.
What's that?
There's a difference between being and doing, and most people have placed their emphasis on the latter.
Shouldn't they?
There's no should or should not involved. There's only what you choose and how you can have it. If you choose peace and joy and love, you won't get much of it through what you're doing. If you choose happiness and contentment, you'll find little of that on the path of doingness. If you choose reunion with God, supreme knowing, deep understanding, endless compassion, total awareness, absolute fulfillment, you won't achieve much of that out of what you're doing. In other words, if you choose evolution, the evolution of your soul, you won't produce that by the worldly activities of your body. Doing is a function of the body. Being is a function of the soul. The body is always doing something. Every minute of every day it's up to something. It never stops. It never rests. It's constantly doing something. It's either doing what it's doing at the behest of the soul or in spite of the soul. The quality of your life hangs in the balance. The soul is forever being. It is being what it is being, regardless of what the body is doing, not because of what it's doing. If you think your life is about doingness, you do not understand what you are about. Your soul doesn't care what you do for a living. And when your life is over, neither will you. Your soul cares only about what you're being while you're doing whatever you're doing. It is the state of beingness the soul is after, not a state of doingness.
What is the soul seeking to be?
Me.
You?
Yes, me. Your soul is me, and it knows it. What it is doing is trying to experience that. And what it is remembering is that the best way to have this experience is by not doing anything. There is nothing to do but to be.
Be what?
Whatever you want to be. Happy, sad, weak, strong, joyful, vengeful, insightful, blind, good, bad, male, female, you name it. I mean that literally. You name it.
Now, this is all very profound, but I don't know what it has to do with my career. I'm trying to find a way to stay alive, to survive, to support my family and myself, doing what I like to do.
Try being what you like to be.
What do you mean?
Some people make lots of money doing what they do. Others can't make a go of it, and they're doing the same thing. What makes the difference?
Well, some people have more skill than others.
That's the first cut. But now we get to the second cut. Now we're down to two people with relatively equal skills. Both graduated from college. Both were at the top of their class. Both understand the nature of what they're doing. Both know how to use their tools with great facility. Yet one still does better than the other. One flourishes while the other struggles. What's that about?
Location.
Location?
Well, somebody once told me there are only three things to consider when starting a new business. Location, location, and location.
In other words, not what are you going to do, but where are you going to be?
Exactly.
That sounds like the answer to my question as well. The soul is concerned only with where you are going to be. Are you going to be in a place called fear or in a place called love? Where are you? And where are you coming from as you encounter life? Now, in the example of the two equally qualified workers, one is successful and the other is not. Not because of anything either is doing, but because of what both are being. One person is being open, friendly, caring, helpful, considerate, cheerful, confident, even joyful in her work, while the other is being closed, distant, uncaring, inconsiderate, grumpy, even resentful of what she is doing. Now, suppose you were to select even loftier states of beingness. Suppose you were to select goodness, mercy, compassion, understanding, forgiveness, love. What if you were to select godliness? What then would be your experience? I tell you this, beingness attracts beingness and produces experience. You are not on this planet to produce anything with your body. You are on this planet to produce something with your soul. Your body is simply and merely the tool of your soul. Your mind is the power that makes the body go. So what you have here is a power tool used in the creation of the soul's desire.
What is the soul's desire?
Indeed, what is it?
I don't know, I'm asking you.
I don't know, I'm asking you.
This could go on forever.
It has.
Wait a minute. A moment ago you said the soul is seeking to be you.
So it is.
Well, then that's the soul's desire.
In the broadest sense, yes. But this me it is seeking to be is very complex, very multidimensional, multisensual, multifaceted. There are a million aspects to me, a billion, a trillion, you see? There is the profane and the profound, the lesser and the larger, the hollow and the holy, the ghastly and the godly. You see?
Yes. Yes, I do see. The up and the down, the left and the right, the here and the there, the before and the after, the good and the bad.
Precisely. I am the Alpha and the Omega. That was not just a pretty saying or a nifty concept. That was truth expressed. So, in seeking to be me, the soul has a grand job ahead of it, an enormous menu of beingness from which to choose. And that is what it is doing in this moment, now.
Choosing states of being.
Yes. And then producing the right and perfect conditions within which to create the experience of that. It is therefore true that nothing happens to you or through you that is not for your own highest good.
Do you mean my soul is creating all of my experience, including not only the things I'm doing, but the things that are happening to me?
Let us say that the soul leads you to the right and perfect opportunities for you to experience exactly what you had planned to experience. What you actually experience is up to you. It could be what you plan to experience, or it could be something else, depending upon what you choose.
Well, why would I choose something I don't want to experience?
I don't know. Why would you?
Do you mean that sometimes the soul wishes one thing and the body or the mind wishes another?
What do you think?
But how can the body or the mind overrule the soul? Doesn't the soul always get what it wants?
The spirit of you seeks, in the largest sense, that grand moment when you have conscious awareness of its wishes and join in joyful oneness with them. But the spirit will never, ever force its desire on the present conscious physical part of you. The Father will not force his will upon the Son. It is a violation of his very nature to do so, and thus quite literally impossible. The Son will not force his will upon the Holy Spirit. It is against his very nature to do so, and thus, quite literally, impossible. The Holy Spirit will not force his will upon your soul. It is outside of the nature of the Spirit to do so, and thus, quite literally, impossible. Here is where the impossibilities end. The mind very often does seek to exert its will on the body. And does so. Similarly, the body seeks often to control the mind, and frequently succeeds. Yet the body and the mind together do not have to do anything to control the soul, for the soul is completely without need, unlike the body and the mind, which are shackled with it, and so always allows the body and the mind to have their way all the time. Indeed, the soul would have it no other way. For if the entity, which is you, is to create, and thus know who it really is, it must be through an act of conscious volition, not an act of unconscious obedience. Obedience is not creation, and thus can never produce salvation. Obedience is a response, while creation is pure choice, undictated, unrequired. Pure choice produces salvation through the pure creation of highest idea in this moment, now. The function of the soul is to indicate its desire, not impose it. The function of the mind is to choose from its alternatives. The function of the body is to act out that choice. When body, mind, and soul create together in harmony and in unity, God is made flesh. Then does the soul know itself in its own experience. Then do the heavens rejoice. Right now, in this moment, your soul has again created opportunity for you to be, do, and have what it takes to know who you really are. Your soul has brought you to the words you are listening to right now, as it has brought you to words of wisdom and truth before. What will you do now? What will you choose to be? Your soul waits and watches with interest, as it has many times before.
Do I understand you to say that it is out of the state of beingness I select my worldly success? I'm still trying to talk about my career here, and how that'll be determined?
I'm not concerned about your worldly success, only you are. It's true that when you achieve certain states of being over a long period of time, success in what you are doing in the world is very difficult to avoid. Yet you are not to worry about making a living. True masters are those who have chosen to make a life rather than a living. From certain states of being will spring a life so rich, so full, so magnificent, and so rewarding that worldly goods and worldly success will be of no concern to you. Life's irony is that as soon as worldly goods and worldly success are of no concern to you, the way is open for them to flow to you. Remember, you cannot have what you want, but you may experience whatever you have.
I can't have what I want?
No.
I thought you've been telling me that I could have whatever I want. As you think, as you believe, so shall it be done unto you, and all that.
The two statements are not inconsistent with each other?
They aren't. They sure as hell feel inconsistent to me.
That's because you lack understanding.
Well, I admit that. That's why I'm talking with you.
I will then explain. You cannot have anything you want. The very act of wanting something pushes it away from you.
You're losing me fast.
Fight to keep up. I'll go over it again in greater detail. Try to stay with it now. Let's go back to a point you do understand. Thought is creative, okay?
Okay.
Word is creative. Got it?
Got it.
Action is creative. Thought, word, and deed are the three levels of creation. Still with me?
Right there.
Good. Now, let's take worldly success as our subject for the moment, since that's what you've been talking about, asking about.
Terrific.
Now, do you have a thought, I want worldly success?
Sometimes, yes.
And do you also sometimes have the thought, I want more money?
Yes.
You can therefore neither have worldly success nor more money.
But why not?
The universe has no choice but to bring you the direct manifestation of your thought about it. Your thought is, I want worldly success. You understand? The creative power is like a genie in a bottle. Your words are its command. You understand?
Well, then why don't I have more success?
I said your words are its command. Now, your words were, I want success. And the universe says, okay, you do.
I'm not sure I follow here.
Think of it this way. The word I is the key that starts the engine of creation. The words I am are extremely powerful. They are statements to the universe, commands. Now, whatever follows the word I, which calls forth the great I am, tends to manifest in physical reality. Therefore, I plus want success produces you wanting success. I plus want money must produce you wanting money. It can produce no other thing, Because thoughts, words, are creative. Actions are too. And if you act in a way which says that you want success and money, then your thoughts, words, and actions are in accord. And you are sure to have the experience of this wantingness. You see?
Yes. Yes, my God, I do. Does it really work that way?
Of course. You're a very powerful creator. Now, granted, if you had a thought or made a statement just once, as in anger, for instance, or frustration, it's not very likely that you'll convert those thoughts or words into reality. So you don't have to worry about drop dead or go to hell or all the other less than nice things you sometimes think or say.
Thank God.
You're welcome. But if you repeat a thought or say a word over and over again, not once, not twice, but dozens, hundreds, thousands of times, do you have any idea of the creative power of that? A thought or a word expressed and expressed and expressed becomes just that, expressed. That is, pushed out. It becomes outwardly realized. It becomes your physical reality.
Good grief.
That's exactly what it produces every time. Good grief. You love the grief. You love the drama. That is, until you don't anymore. There comes a certain point in your evolution when you cease to love the drama, cease to love the story as you've been living it. That's when you decide, actively choose to change it. Only most don't know how. You now do. To change your reality, simply stop thinking like that. In this case, instead of thinking, I want success, think, I have success.
Well, that feels like a lie to me. I'd be kidding myself if I said that. My mind would shout, the hell, you say.
Then think a thought you can accept. My success is coming to me now. Or, all things lead to my success.
Ah, so this is the trick behind the New Age practice of affirmations.
Affirmations don't work if they are merely statements of what you want to be true. Affirmations work only when they are statements of something you already know to be true. The best so-called affirmation is a statement of gratitude and appreciation. Thank you, God, for bringing me success in my life. Now, that idea, thought, spoken, and acted upon, produces wonderful results when it comes from true knowing, not from an attempt to produce results, but from an awareness that results have already been produced. Jesus had such clarity. Before every miracle, he thanked me in advance for its deliverance. It never occurred to him not to be grateful, because it never occurred to him that what he declared would not happen. The thought never entered his mind. So sure was he of who he was and of his relationship to me, that his every thought, word, and deed reflected his awareness. Just as your thoughts, words, and deeds reflect yours. If now there is something you choose to experience in your life, do not want it, choose it. Do you choose success in worldly terms? Do you choose more money? Good, then choose it, really, fully, not half-heartedly. Yet at your stage of development, do not be surprised if worldly success no longer concerns you.
What is that supposed to mean?
There comes a time in the evolution of every soul when the chief concern is no longer the survival of the physical body, but the growth of the spirit. No longer the attainment of worldly success, but the realization of self. In a sense, this is a very dangerous time, particularly at the outset, because the entity housed in the body now knows it is just that, a being in a body, not a body being. At this stage, before the growing entity matures in this point of view, there is often a sense of no longer caring about affairs of the body in any way. The soul is so excited about being discovered at last. The mind abandons the body and all matters of the body. Everything is ignored. Relationships are set aside. Families are disappeared. Jobs are made secondary. Bills go unpaid. The body itself is not even fed for long periods. The entire focus and attention of the entity is now on the soul and matters of the soul. This can lead to a major personal crisis in the day-to-day life of the being, although the mind perceives no trauma. It's hanging out in bliss. Other people say you have lost your mind, and in a sense, you may have. Discovery of the truth that life has nothing to do with the body can create an imbalance the other way. Whereas at first the entity acted as if the body were all there is, now it acts as if the body matters not at all. This, of course, is not true, as the entity soon, and sometimes painfully, remembers. You are a tripart being made of body, mind, and spirit. You will always be a tripart being, not just while you are living on the earth. There are those who hypothesize that upon death the body and mind are dropped. The body and the mind are not dropped. The body changes form, leaving its most dense part behind, but retaining always its outer shell. The mind, not to be confused with the brain, goes with you too, joining with the spirit and the body as the one energy mass of three dimensions, or facets. Should you choose to return to this experiencing opportunity that you call life on earth, your divine self will once again separate its true dimensions into what you call body, mind, and spirit. In truth, you are all one energy, yet with three distinct characteristics. As you undertake to inhabit a new physical body here on earth, your ethereal body, as some of you have termed it, lowers its vibrations, slows itself from a vibration so rapid that it cannot even be seen, to a speed that produces mass and matter. This actual matter is the creation of pure thought, the work of your mind, the higher mind aspect of your three-part being. This matter is a coagulation of a million, billion, trillion different energy units into one enormous mass, controllable by the mind. You really are a mastermind. As these tiny energy units have expended their energy, they are discarded by the body, while the mind creates new ones. This the mind creates out of its continuing thought about who you are. The ethereal body catches the thought, so to speak, and lowers the vibration of more energy units, in a sense, crystallizes them, and they become matter, the new matter of you. In this way, every cell of your body changes every several years. You are quite literally not the same person you were a few years ago. If you think thoughts of illness or disease, or continuing anger, hatred, and negativity, your body will translate these thoughts into physical form. People will see this negative, sick form, and they will say, "What's the matter?" They will not know how accurate their question is. The soul watches this whole drama play out year after year, month after month, day after day, moment after moment, and always holds the truth about you. It never forgets the blueprint, the original plan, the first idea, the creative thought. Its job is to remind you, that is to literally remind you, so that you may remember once again who you are, and then choose who you now wish to be. In this way, the cycle of creation and experience, imaging and fulfilling, knowing and growing into the unknown continues both now and even forevermore.
Whoa.
Yes, exactly. Oh, and there's much more to explain. So much more. But never ever in one dialogue, nor probably not even in one lifetime. Yet you have begun, and that is good. Just remember this. It is as your grand teacher, William Shakespeare, said, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
May I ask you some questions about this? Well, like when you say the mind goes with me after death, does that mean my personality goes with me? Will I know in the afterlife who I was?
Yes, and who you have ever been. It will all be opened unto you, because then it will profit you to know. Now, in this moment, it will not.
And with regard to this life, will there be an accounting, a review, a tally-taking?
There is no judgment in what you call the afterlife. You will not even be allowed to judge yourself, for you would surely give yourself a low score, given how judgmental and unforgiving you are with yourself in this life. No, there is no accounting, no one giving thumbs up or thumbs down. Only humans are judgmental. And because you are, you assume that I must be. Yet I am not. And that is a great truth you cannot accept. Nonetheless, while there will be no judgment in the afterlife, there will be opportunity to look again at all you have thought, said, and done here, and to decide if that is what you would choose again, based on who you say you are and who you want to be.
There's an Eastern mystical teaching surrounding a doctrine called Kamaloka. According to this teaching, at the time of our death, each person is given the opportunity to relive every thought ever entertained, every word ever spoken, every action ever taken. Not from our standpoint, but from the standpoint of every other person affected. In other words, we've already experienced what we felt, thinking, saying, and doing what we did, and now we're given the experience of feeling what the other person felt in each of these moments. And it is by this measure that we decide whether we'll think, say, or do those things again. Any comment on that?
What occurs in your life after this is far too extraordinary to describe it here in terms you could comprehend, because the experience is other dimensional. It literally defies description using tools as severely limited as words. It's enough to say that you will have the opportunity to review again this, your present life, without pain or fear or judgment, for the purpose of deciding how you feel about your experience here and where you want to go from there. Many of you will decide to come back here, to return to this world of density and relativity for another chance to experience out the decisions and choices you make about yourself at this level. Others of you, a select few, will return with a different mission. You will return to density and matter for the sole purpose of bringing others out of density and matter. Always there are on the earth those among you who have made such a choice. You can tell them apart at once. Their work is finished. They have returned to earth simply and merely to help others. This is their joy. This is their exaltation. They seek naught but to be of service. You cannot miss these people. They are everywhere. There are more of them than you think. Chances are you know one, or know of one.
Am I one?
No. If you have to ask, you know you are not one. One such as this asks questions of no one. There's nothing to ask.
This is the end of Side 9. Please fast forward the tape to the end to queue up Side 10 for your listening.
You, my son, in this lifetime, are a messenger, a harbinger, a bringer of news, a seeker, and frequently a speaker of truth. That is enough for one lifetime. Be happy.
Oh, I am, but I could always hope for more.
Yes, and you will. Always you will hope for more. It is in your nature. It is divine nature to seek always to be more. So seek, yes, by all means, seek. Now I want to answer definitively the question with which you started this segment of our ongoing conversation. Go ahead and do what you really love to do. Do nothing else. You have so little time. How can you think of wasting a moment doing something for a living you don't like to do? What kind of a living is that? That is not a living. That is a dying. If you say, but I have others who depend on me, little mouths to feed, a spouse who is looking to me, I will answer, if you insist that your life is about what your body is doing, you do not understand why you came here. At least do something that pleases you, that speaks of who you are. Then at least you can stay out of resentment and anger toward those you imagine are keeping you from your joy. What your body is doing is not to be discounted. It is important, but not in the way you think. The actions of the body were meant to be reflections of a state of being, not attempts to attain a state of being.
In the true order of things, one does not do something in order to be happy.
One is happy, and hence does something.
One does not do some things in order to be compassionate. One is compassionate and hence acts in a certain way. The soul's decision precedes the body's action in a highly conscious person. Only an unconscious person attempts to produce a state of the soul through something the body is doing. This is what is meant by the statement, your life is not about what your body is doing. Yet it is true that what your body is doing is a reflection of what your life is about. It is another divine dichotomy. Yet know this, if you understand nothing else. You have a right to your joy. Children or no children, spouse or no spouse. Seek it, find it, and you will have a joyful family no matter how much money you make or don't make. And if they aren't joyful and they get up and leave you, then release them with love to seek their joy. If, on the other hand, you have evolved to the point where things of the body are not of concern to you, then you are even more free to seek your joy on earth as it is in heaven. God says it's okay to be happy. Yes, even happy in your work. Your life work is a statement of who you are. If it is not, then why are you doing it? Do you imagine that you have to? You don't have to do anything. If man who supports his family at all costs, even his own happiness, is who you are, then love your work because it is facilitating your creation of a living statement of self. If woman who works a job she hates in order to meet responsibilities as she sees them is who you are, then love, love, love your job, for it totally supports your self-image, your self-concept. Everyone can love everything the moment they understand what they are doing and why. No one does anything he doesn't want to do.
How could I solve some of the health problems I face? I've been the victim of enough chronic problems to last three lifetimes. Why am I having them all now in this lifetime?
First, let's get one thing straight. You love them. Most of them, anyway. You use them admirably to feel sorry for yourself and to get attention for yourself. On the few occasions when you haven't loved them, it's only because they've gone too far. Farther than you thought they ever would when you created them. Now let's understand what you already know. All illness is self-created. Even conventional medical doctors are now seeing how people make themselves sick. Most people do so quite unconsciously. They don't even know what they're doing. So when they get sick, they don't know what hit them. It feels as though something has befallen them, rather than that they did something to themselves. This occurs because most people move through life, not simply health issues and consequences, unconsciously. People smoke and wonder why they get cancer. People ingest animals and fat and wonder why they get blocked arteries. People stay angry all their lives and wonder why they get heart attacks. People compete with other people mercilessly and under incredible stress and wonder why they have strokes. The not-so-obvious truth is that most people worry themselves to death. Worry is just about the worst form of mental activity there is, next to hate, which is deeply self-destructive. Worry is pointless. It is wasted mental energy. It also creates biochemical reactions which harm the body, producing everything from indigestion to coronary arrest, and a multitude of things in between. Health will improve almost at once when worrying ends. Worry is the activity of a mind which does not understand its connection with me. Hatred is the most severely damaging mental condition. It poisons the body, and its effects are virtually irreversible. Fear is the opposite of everything you are, and so has an effect of opposition to your mental and physical health. Fear is worry magnified. Worry, hate, fear, together with their offshoots, anxiety, bitterness, impatience, avarice, unkindness, judgmentalness, and condemnation, all attack the body at the cellular level. It is impossible to have a healthy body under these conditions. Similarly, although to a somewhat lesser degree, conceit, self-indulgence, and greed lead to physical illness or lack of well-being. All illness is created first in the mind.
How can that be? What if conditions contracted from another? Colds, or for that matter, AIDS?
Nothing occurs in your life. Nothing which is not first a thought. Thoughts are like magnets, drawing effects to you. The thought may not always be obvious and thus clearly causative, as in, I'm going to contract a terrible disease. The thought may be, and usually is, far more subtle than that. I am not worthy to live. My life is always a mess. I am a loser. God is going to punish me. I am sick and tired of my life. Thoughts are a very subtle, yet extremely powerful form of energy. Words are less subtle, more dense. Actions are the most dense of all. Action is energy in heavy physical form, in heavy motion. When you think, say, and act out a negative concept such as, I am a loser, you place tremendous creative energy into motion. Small wonder you come down with a cold. That would be the least of it. It is very difficult to reverse the effects of negative thinking once they have taken physical form. Not impossible, but very difficult. It takes an act of extreme faith. It requires an extraordinary belief in the positive force of the universe. Whether you call that God, Goddess, the unmoved mover, prime force, first cause, or whatever. Healers have just such faith. It is a faith that crosses over into absolute knowing. They know that you are meant to be whole, complete, and perfect in this moment now. This knowingness is also a thought, and a very powerful one. It has the power to move mountains, to say nothing of molecules in your body. That is why healers can heal, often even at a distance. Thought knows no distance. Thought travels around the world and traverses the universe faster than you can say the word. Say but the word, and my servant shall be healed. And it was so in that selfsame hour, even before his sentence was finished. Such was the faith of the centurion. Yet you are all mental lepers. Your mind is eaten away with negative thoughts. Some of these are thrust upon you. Many of these you actually make up, conjure up yourselves, and then harbor and entertain for hours, days, weeks, months, even years. Then you wonder why you are sick. You can solve some of the health problems, as you put it, by solving the problems in your thinking. Yes, you can heal some of the conditions you have already acquired, given yourself, as well as prevent major new problems from developing. And you can do this all by changing your thinking. Also, and I hate to suggest this because it sounds so mundane, coming as it were from God, but for God's sake, take better care of yourself. You take rotten care of your body, paying it little attention at all until you suspect something's gone wrong with it. You do virtually nothing in the way of preventive maintenance. You take better care of your car than you do of your body. And that's not saying much. Not only do you fail to prevent breakdowns with regular checkups once a year, physicals, and use of the therapies and medicines you've been given, why do you go to the doctor, get her help, then not use the remedies she suggests? Can you answer me that one? You also mistreat your body terribly between these visits, about which you do nothing. You do not exercise it, so it grows flabby and, worse yet, weak from non-use. You do not nourish it properly, thereby weakening it further. Then you fill it with toxins and poisons and the most absurd substances, posing as food. And still it runs for you, this marvelous engine. Still it chugs along, bravely pushing on in the face of this onslaught. It's horrible. The conditions under which you ask your body to survive are horrible. But you will do little or nothing about them. You will hear this, nod your head in regretful agreement, and go right back to the mistreatment. And do you know why?
I'm afraid to ask.
Because you have no will to live.
That seems a harsh indictment.
It's not meant to be harsh, nor is it meant as an indictment. Harsh is a relative term, a judgment you have laid on the words. Indictment connotes guilt, and guilt connotes wrongdoing. There is no wrongdoing involved here, hence no guilt and no indictment. I have made a simple statement of truth. Like all statements of truth, it has the quality of waking you up. Some people don't like to be awakened. Most do not. Most would rather sleep. The world is in the condition that it's in because the world is full of sleepwalkers. With regard to my statement, what about it seems untrue? You have no will to live. At least you have had none until now. If you tell me you've had an instant conversion, I will reassess my prediction of what you will now do. I acknowledge that my prediction is based on past experience. It was also meant to wake you up. Sometimes when a person is really deeply asleep, you have to shake him a little. I've seen in the past that you have had little will to live. Now, you may deny that, but in this case, your actions speak louder than your words. If you ever lit a cigarette in your life, much less smoked a pack a day for 20 years as you have very little will to live. You don't care what you do to your body.
But I stopped smoking 10 years ago.
Only after 20 years of grueling physical punishment. And if you've ever taken alcohol into your body, you have very little will to live.
I drink very moderately.
The body was not meant to intake alcohol. It impairs the mind.
But Jesus took alcohol. He went to the wedding and turned water into wine.
So who said Jesus was perfect?
Oh, for God's sake.
Say, are you becoming annoyed with me?
Well, far be it from me to become annoyed with God. I mean, that would be a bit presumptuous, wouldn't it? But I do think we can carry this a bit too far. My father taught me all things in moderation. I think I've stuck to that where alcohol is concerned.
The body can more easily recover from only moderate abuse. The saying is therefore useful. Nevertheless, I'll stick to my original statement. The body was not meant to intake alcohol.
But even some medicines contain alcohol.
I have no control over what you call medicine. I'll stay with my statement.
You really are rigid, aren't you?
Look, truth is truth. Now, if someone said, a little alcohol won't hurt you, and placed that statement in the context of life as you now live it, I would have to agree with them. That does not change the truth of what I've said. It simply allows you to ignore it. Then consider this. Currently, you humans wear your bodies out typically within 50 to 80 years. Some last longer, but not many. Some stop functioning sooner, but not the majority. Can we agree on that?
Yes, okay.
All right, so we have a good starting point for discussion. Now, when I said I could agree with the statement, a little alcohol won't hurt you, I qualified that by adding, in the context of life as you now live it. You see, you people seem satisfied with life as you now live it. But life, it may surprise you to learn, was meant to be lived a whole different way. And your body was designed to last a great deal longer.
It was?
Yes.
How much longer?
Infinitely longer.
What does that mean?
It means, my son, your body was designed to last forever.
Forever?
Yes, forevermore.
You mean that we are never supposed to die?
You never do die. Life is eternal. You are immortal. You never do die. You simply change form. You didn't even have to do that. You decided to do that. I didn't. I made you bodies that would last forever. Do you really think the best God could do, the best I could come up with, was a body that could make it 60, 70, maybe 80 years before falling apart? Is that, do you imagine, the limit of my ability?
I never thought of putting it that way exactly.
I designed your magnificent body to last forever. And the earliest of you did live in the body, virtually pain-free and without fear of what you now call death. In your religious mythology, you symbolize your cellular memory of these first version humans by calling them Adam and Eve. Actually, of course, there were more than two. At the outset, the idea was for you wonderful souls to have a chance to know yourselves as who you really are through experiences gained in the physical body, in the relative world, as I have explained repeatedly here. This was done through the slowing down of the unfathomable speed of all vibration, thought form, to produce matter, including that matter you call the physical body. Life evolved through a series of steps in the blink of an eye that you now call billions of years. And in this holy instant came you, out of the sea, the water of life, onto the land, and into the form you now hold.
Then the evolutionists are right.
I find it amusing, a source of continual amusement, actually, that you humans have such a need to break everything down into right and wrong. It never occurs to you that you've made those labels up to help you define the material and yourself. It never occurs to you, except to the finest minds among you, that a thing could be both right and wrong, that only in the relative world are things one or the other. In the world of the absolute, of time, no time, all things are everything. There is no male and female. There's no before and after. There is no fast and slow, here and there, up and down, left and right, and no right and wrong. Your astronauts and cosmonauts have gained a sense of this. They imagined themselves to be rocketing upward to get to outer space, only to find when they got there that they were looking up at the Earth. Or were they? Maybe they were looking down at the Earth. But then, where was the sun? Up, down? No? Over there. To the left. So now suddenly a thing was neither up nor down, it was sideways, and all definitions thus disappeared. So it is in my world, our real realm. All definitions disappear, rendering it difficult to even talk about this realm in definitive terms. Religion is your attempt to speak of the unspeakable. It does not do a very good job. No, my son, the evolutionists are not right. I created all of this, in the blink of an eye. In one holy instant, just as the creationists have said. And it came about through a process of evolution, taking billions and billions of what you call years. Just as the evolutionists claim. They are both right. As the cosmonauts discovered, it all depends on how you look at it. But the real question is, one holy instant, billions of years, what's the difference? Can you simply agree that on some of the questions of life, the mystery is too great for even you to solve? Why not hold the mystery as sacred? And why not allow the sacred to be sacred and leave it alone?
I suppose we all have an insatiable need to know.
But you already know. I've just told you. Yet you don't want to know the truth. You want to know the truth as you understand it. This is the greatest barrier to your enlightenment. You think you already know the truth. You think you already understand how it is. So you agree with everything you see or hear or read that falls into the paradigm of your understanding and reject everything which does not. And this you call learning. This you call being open to the teachings. Alas, you can never be open to the teaching so long as you are closed to everything save your own truth. Thus will this very dialogue be called blasphemy, the work of the devil by some. Yet those who have ears to hear, let them listen. I tell you this, you were not meant to ever die. Your physical form was created as a magnificent convenience, a wonderful tool, a glorious vehicle, allowing you to experience the reality you have created with your mind, that you may know the self you have created in your soul.
The soul conceives, the mind creates, the body experiences. The circle is complete. The soul then knows itself in its own experience. If it does not like what it is experiencing, feeling, or wishes a different experience for any reason, it simply conceives of a new experience of self and quite literally changes its mind. Soon the body finds itself in a new experience. I am the resurrection and the life was a magnificent example of this. How do you think Jesus did it anyway? Or do you not believe it ever happened? Believe it. It happened. Yet this much is so. The soul will never override the body or the mind. I made you as a three-in-one being. You are three beings and one made in the image and likeness of me. The three aspects of self are in no wise unequal to each other. Each has a function, but no function is greater than another. Nor does any function actually precede another. All are interrelated in an exactly equal way. Conceive, create, experience. What you conceive, you create. What you create, you experience. What you experience, you conceive. That is why it is said, if you can cause your body to experience something, take abundance for example, you will soon have the feeling of it in your soul, which will conceive of itself in a new way, namely, abundant. Thus presenting your mind with a new thought about that. From the new thought springs more experience, and the body begins living a new reality as a permanent state of being. Your body, your mind, and your soul, spirit, are one. In this, you are a microcosm of me, the divine all, the holy everything, the sum and substance. You see now how I am the beginning and the end of everything, the Alpha and the Omega. Now, I will explain to you the ultimate mystery, your exact and true relationship to me. You are my body. As your body is to your mind and soul, so too are you to my mind and soul. Therefore, everything I experience through you. Just as your body, mind, and spirit are one, so too are mine. So it is that Jesus of Nazareth, among the many who understood this mystery, spoke immutable truth when he said, I and the Father are one. Now I will tell you, there are even larger truths than this to which you will one day become privy. For even as you are the body of me, I am the body of another.
You mean you are not God?
Yes, I am God, as you now understand him.
I am Goddess, as you now comprehend her. I am the conceiver and the creator of everything you now know and experience, and you are my children, even as I am the child of another.
Are you trying to tell me that even God has a God?
I am telling you that your perception of ultimate reality is more limited than you thought, and that truth is more unlimited than you can imagine. I am giving you ever so small a glimpse of infinity. An infinite love. A much larger glimpse, and you could not hold it in your reality. You can barely hold this.
Wait a minute. You mean I'm not really talking with God here?
I've told you, if you conceive of God as your creator and master, even as you are the creator and master of your own body, I am the God of your understanding. And you are talking with me, yes. It's been a delicious conversation, no?
Well, delicious or not, I thought I was talking with the real God, the God of gods, you know, the top guy, the chief honcho.
You are. Believe me. You are.
And yet you say that there is someone above you in this hierarchical scheme of things.
We are now trying to do the impossible, which is to speak of the unspeakable. As I said, that is what religion seeks to do. Let me see if I can find a way to summarize this. Forever is longer than you know. Eternal is longer than forever. God is more than you imagine. God is the energy you call imagination. God is creation. God is first thought, and God is last experience, and God is everything in between. Have you ever looked down a high-powered microscope or seen pictures or movies of molecular action and said, "Good heavens, there's a whole universe down there"? And to that universe, I, the now-present observer, must feel like God. Have you ever said that or had that kind of experience?
Sure, I would imagine every thinking person has.
Indeed. You have given yourself your own glimpse of what I am showing you here. And what would you do if I told you that this reality of which you have given yourself a glimpse never ends?
Explain that? I'd like to ask you to explain that.
Take the smallest part of the universe you can imagine. Imagine this tiny, tiny particle of matter.
Okay.
Now cut it in half.
Okay.
What have you got?
Oh, two smaller halves.
Precisely. Now cut those in half. What now?
Two smaller halves.
Right. Now again and again, what's left?
Smaller and smaller particles.
Yes, but when does it stop? How many times can you divide matter until it ceases to exist?
I don't know. I guess it never ceases to exist.
You mean you can never completely destroy it? All you can do is change its form?
It would seem so.
I tell you this. You have just learned the secret of all of life and seen into infinity. Now I have a question to ask you.
Okay.
What makes you think infinity goes only one way?
Oh, so there's no end going up any more than there's an end going down.
There is no up or down, but I understand your meaning.
But if there's no end to smallness, well, that means there's no end to bigness.
Correct.
But if there's no end to bigness, then there's no biggest. That means, in the largest sense, there's no God.
Or perhaps all of it is God, and there is nothing else. I tell you this. I am that I am. And you are that you are. You cannot not be. You can change form all you wish, but you cannot fail to be. Yet you can fail to know who you are. And in this failing, experience only the half of it.
That would be hell.
Exactly. Yet you are not condemned to it. You are not relegated to it forevermore. All that it takes to get out of hell, to get out of not knowing, is to know again. There are many ways and many places, dimensions, in which you can do this. You are in one of those dimensions now. It is called, in your understanding, the third dimension.
And there are many more?
Have I not told you that in my kingdom there are many mansions? I would not have told it to you were it not so.
Well, then there is no hell, not really. I mean, there's no place or dimension to which we are everlastingly condemned.
What would be the purpose of that? Yet you are always limited by your knowingness, for you, we, are a self-created being. You cannot be what you do not know yourself to be. That is why you have been given this life, so that you might know yourself in your own experience. Then you can conceive of yourself as who you really are and create yourself as that in your experience. And the circle is again complete, only bigger. And so you are in the process of growing, or as I have put it before, of becoming. There is no limit to what you can become.
You mean I can even become, a god, just like you?
What do you think?
I don't know.
Until you do, you cannot. Remember the triangle, the Holy Trinity, spirit, mind, body. Conceive, create, experience. Remember, using your symbology, Holy Spirit equals inspiration, equals conceive. Father equals parenting, equals create. Son equals offspring, equals experience. The Son experiences the creation of the fathering thought, which is conceived of by the Holy Ghost. Can you conceive of yourself as one day being a God?
In my wildest dreams, in my wildest moments.
Good, for I tell you this, you are already a God. You simply do not know it. Have I not said, ye are gods? There now. I have explained it all for you. Life. How it works. Its very reason and purpose. How else can I serve you?
There's nothing more I could ask. I'm filled with thanks for this incredible dialogue. It's been so far-reaching, so encompassing. You know, I had more questions to ask, but somehow these discussions make those questions seem irrelevant.
Yes. Still, you wanted to ask them. Let's just quickly answer the remainder of them one by one, now that we're moving this rapidly through the material.
What material?
The material I brought you here to expose you to. Now that we're moving through the material, let's just take those remaining questions and deal with them quickly.
All right, what is the karmic lesson I'm supposed to be learning here? What am I trying to master?
You are learning nothing here. You have nothing to learn. You have only to remember. That is, remember me. What are you trying to master? You are trying to master mastering itself.
Is there such a thing as reincarnation? How many past lives have I had? What was I in them? Is karmic debt a reality?
It's difficult to believe there is still a question about this. I find it hard to imagine. There have been so many reports from thoroughly reliable sources of past life experiences. Some of these people have brought back strikingly detailed descriptions of events and such completely verifiable data as to eliminate any possibility that they were making it up or had contrived to somehow deceive researchers and loved ones. You have had 647 past lives, since you insist on being exact. This is your 648th. You were everything in them. A king, a queen, a serf, a teacher, a student, a master, a male, a female, a warrior, a pacifist, a hero, a coward, a killer, a savior, a sage, a fool. You've been all of it. No, there is no such thing as karmic debt. Not in the sense that you mean in this question. A debt is something that must or should be repaid. You are not obligated to do anything. Still, there are certain things that you want to do, choose to experience, and some of these choices hinge on the desire for them has been created by what you have experienced before. And that is as close as words can come to this thing you call karma. If karma is the innate desire to be better, to be bigger, to evolve and to grow, and to look at past events and experiences as a measure of that, then yes. Karma does exist, but it does not require anything. Nothing is ever required. You are, as always you have ever been, a being of free choice.
I sometimes feel very psychic. Is there such a thing as being psychic? And am I that? Are people who claim to be psychic trafficking with the devil?
Yes, there is such a thing as being psychic. You are that. Everyone is that. There is not a person who does not have what you call psychic ability. There are only people who do not use it. Using psychic ability is nothing more than using your sixth sense. Obviously, this is not trafficking with the devil, or I would not have given the sense to you. And of course, there is no devil with whom to traffic.
Is sex okay? Come on, what is the real story behind this human experience? Is sex purely for procreation, as some religions say? Is true holiness and enlightenment achieved through denial or transmutation of the sexual energy? Is it okay to have sex without love? Is just the physical sensation of it okay enough as a reason?
Of course sex is okay. Again, if I didn't want you to play certain games, I wouldn't have given you the toys. Do you give your children things you don't want them to play with? Play with sex. Play with it. It's wonderful fun. Why, it's just about the most fun you can have with your body, if you're talking of strictly physical experiences alone. Now, for goodness sake, don't destroy sexual innocence and pleasure and the purity of the fun, the joy, by misusing sex. Don't use it for power or hidden purpose, for ego gratification or domination, for any purpose other than the purest joy and the highest ecstasy given and shared, which is love and love recreated, which is new life. Have I not chosen the delicious way to make more of you? With regard to denial, I've dealt with that before. Nothing holy has ever been achieved through denial. Yet desires change as even larger realities are glimpsed. It is not unusual, therefore, for people to simply desire less or even no sexual activity. Or for that matter, any of a number of activities of the body. For some, the activities of the soul become foremost and by far the more pleasurable. Each to his own without judgment. That is the motto. The end of your question is answered this way. You don't need to have a reason for anything. Just be cause. Be the cause of your experience. Remember, experience produces concept of self. Conception produces creation. Creation produces experience. You want to experience yourself as a person who has sex without love? Go ahead. You'll do that until you don't want to anymore. And the only thing that will, that could ever, cause you to stop this or any behavior is your newly emerging thought about who you are. It's as simple and as complex as that.
Why did you make sex so good, so spectacular, so powerful a human experience if all we're supposed to be doing is staying away from it as much as we can? What gives? And for that matter, why are all fun things either immoral, illegal, or fattening?
I've answered the end of this question with what I've just said. All fun things are not immoral, illegal, or fattening. Your life is, however, an interesting exercise in defining what fun is. To some, fun means sensations of the body. To others, fun may be something entirely different. It all depends on who you think you are and what you are doing here. There is much more to be said about sex than is being said here, but nothing more essential than this. Sex is joy. And many of you have made sex everything else but. Sex is sacred, too. Yes, but joy and sacredness do mix. They are, in fact, the same things, and many of you think they do not. Your attitudes about sex form a microcosm of your attitudes about life. Life should be a joy, a celebration, and it has become an experience of fear, anxiety, not enoughness, envy, rage, and tragedy. The same can be said about sex. You have repressed sex, even as you have repressed life, rather than fully self-expressing with abandon and joy. You have shamed sex, even as you have shamed life, calling it evil and wicked, rather than the highest gift and the greatest pleasure. Before you protest that you have not shamed life, look at your collective attitudes about it. 4/5 of the world's people consider life a trial, a tribulation, a time of testing, a karmic debt that must be paid, a school with harsh lessons that must be learned, and in general, an experience to be endured while awaiting the real joy, which is after death. It's a shame that so many of you think this way. Small wonder you have applied shame to the very act which creates life. The energy which underscores sex is the energy which underscores life, which is life. The feeling of attraction and the intense and often urgent desire to move toward each other, to become one, is the essential dynamic of all that lives. I have built it into everything. It is inbred, inherent, inside all that is. The moral codes, religious constrictions, social taboos, and emotional conventions you have placed around sex, and by the way, around love and all of life, have made it virtually impossible for you to celebrate your being. From the beginning of time, all man has ever wanted is to love and be loved. And from the beginning of time, man has done everything in his power to make it impossible to do that. sex is an extraordinary expression of love. Love of another, love of self, love of life. You ought to therefore love it. And you do. You just can't tell anyone you do. You don't dare show how much you love it, or you'll be called a pervert. Yet this is the idea that is perverted. For you personally, simply know this. I have given you nothing shameful, least of all your very body and its functions. There is no need to hide your body or its functions, nor your love of them and of each other. Your television programs think nothing of showing naked violence, but shrink from showing naked love. Your whole society reflects that priority.
Is there life on other planets? Have we been visited by it? Are we being observed now? Will we see evidence, irrevocable and indisputable, of extraterrestrial life in our lifetime? Does each form of life have its own God? Are you the God of all of it?
Yes to the first part. Yes to the second. Yes to the third. I cannot answer the fourth part, since that would require me to predict the future, something I am not going to do.
Is that it? Is that all for now? Are we to speak no more here?
You miss me already?
I do. I do. This has been fun. Are we quitting now?
You need a little rest. There's a lot here to absorb, a lot to wrestle with, a lot to ponder. Take some time off. Reflect on this. Ponder it. Don't feel abandoned. I'm always with you. If you have questions, day-to-day questions, as I know you do even now and will continue to, know that you can call on me to answer them. This is not the only way I speak to you. Listen to me in the truth of your soul. Listen to me in the feelings of your heart. Listen to me in the quiet of your mind. Hear me everywhere. Whenever you have a question, simply know that I have answered it already. Then open your eyes to your world. My response could be in an article already published, in the sermon already written and about to be delivered, in the movie now being made, in the song just yesterday composed, in the words about to be said by a loved one, in the heart of a new friend about to be made. My truth is in the whisper of the wind, the babble of the brook, the crack of the thunder, the tap of the rain. It is the feel of the earth, the fragrance of the lily, the warmth of the sun, the pull of the moon. My truth, and your surest help in time of need, is as awesome as the night sky, and as simply, incontrovertibly trustful as a baby's gurgle. It is as loud as a pounding heartbeat, and as quiet as a breath taken in unity with me. I will not leave you. I cannot leave you. For you are my creation and my product, my daughter and my son, my purpose and my self. Call on me, therefore, wherever and whenever you are separate from the peace that I am.
I will be there.
With truth.
And light.